906.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. For 3 weeks now, the world has been riveted by images of violent clashes between police and riot gear and protesters in the streets of Turkey. What began as a peaceful sit-in to protect a rare piece of green space in the center of Istanbul has exploded into nationwide protests against Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan. As protesters stand silently in defiance in city squares around the country, Erdogan, who's been accused of an increasingly authoritarian rule, has alternately responded with ultimatums for removal of the protesters. Olive branches in the form of face-to-face meetings and talk of a referendum and fiery speeches to large groups of his own supporters. At stake is nothing less than the balance between Turkey's Islamist and secularist traditions, not to mention the potential repercussions for Turkey's neighbors and its relationship with the United States and Europe. Today on The Exchange, the turmoil in Turkey. Let's hear from you. Have you been personally affected by the unrest in Turkey? Do you think comparisons to the Arab Spring or even Occupy Wall Street are accurate? What do you think are the implications for American foreign policy? Should the United States play a role in resolving the crisis? Call into The Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can post comments on our Facebook page. I have three guests joining me in the studio today. One by phone in the studio, they are Aykut Kulinç. Is a PhD candidate at UNH. He studies U.S.-Turkish relationships and is from Istanbul. And Aykut, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you.
Wayne Lesperance is a political science professor at New England College. He studies international relations and U.S. foreign policy. Wayne, welcome back.
Thanks, Dean.
And Zeynep Türkyılmaz. She's a history professor at Dartmouth College. She's an Istanbul native, and she's currently joining us by phone from Istanbul. Zeynep, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into a discussion of the current situation, I want to give our listeners a bit of a primer on Turkey, its form of government, its political traditions, its political culture. So, Wayne, let's start with you. What do you think our listeners should know about Turkey?
Turkey is a very interesting country and in a very interesting part of the world. When we think of that region, often we associate Turkey as being part of the Middle East. And there is something rather exceptional about Turkey in terms of its neighborhood. First, Turkey is a democracy. Turkey has a very rich secular tradition in its history. The father, I suppose you would say, of Turkey, Kemal Atatürk, very much believed in a system of government that would preserve that democracy. So for Turks, the military is seen as the guardian of their system of government, of their freedoms, of their democracy. It's a country that has a very steep and rich history of democratic elections, peaceful democratic elections and transitions of power. Turkey has featured Tansu Çiller in the past, a woman as its leader. So it really stands out in many ways from many of the countries around it. I'd say too that that Turkey, in terms of its identity, in many ways sees itself as being part of Europe as well. So it sort of straddles two continents, Asia and Europe, and so that is also a part of their history. U.S.-Turkish relations over time really grow in intensity beginning after World War II. Turkey was part of the Truman Doctrine. It was a bulwark against Soviet expansion. It was Turkey has been a very strong ally to the United States. It's a member of NATO. So there's a very rich, close alliance system between the United States and Turkey, and we can get into some more of that as we go. Sure. But Turkey has been there has been some hiccups in the past, and we can talk about Cyprus. We can talk about support for the United States in the second war in Iraq. These were low points in our relationship, but overall, I would say that Turkey and the United States have had a very strong relationship since basically the end of World War II.
Aykut, you are from Istanbul. How would you describe your system of government to other graduate students at UNH?
Turkey is a republic. We have two offices, prime ministry and presidential office. Prime Minister Erdogan has been in the office since November 2002. And as Wayne explained, we have had a number of hiccups in our republican democratic history. There were three military coup d'etats in 1960, 1971, and 1980. And again, as Wayne explained, military played a unique role in terms of maintaining, protecting the Republican ideals of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. I think we will get into the details of what's happening over the last few years is the fact that now the tension between modernity and tradition moved from a dichotomy between the military and the conservative class into kind of urban, modern segment of Turkish society with the ruling political party.
And Zeynep, I'd be interested to see if you have anything to add, but I'm also particularly interested if you could say a few words about the relationship between secularism and Islam in Turkey. I think there's some confusion among Americans about whether or not Turkey is an Islamic country or a secular country or how they coexist.
Okay, let me begin with where I stand with this history issue.
Since, sure,
you know,
absolutely.
I do history. So I wouldn't necessarily call the first, let's say, 20 years of Turkish Republic from 1923 to 1945 as a democracy. You know, it was a modernist project. And 1930s, as we all know, was not the high point of democracy in any part of the world. So it was more like an authoritarian way of modernizing, westernizing a country. And Atatürk, for many, undertook that project until his death in 1938, most single-handedly created this secular, westernized image and carved out a national territory for Turks. It was success in many ways, but also it came, you know, it created its own fractures, its own fault lines. And I guess some of the issues, and most of the issues we are dealing with at this point, lies in this initial formulation of what Turkish Republic is mm-hmm. about. In terms of military and non-military regimes, secularism versus Islamists, I mean, majority of people living in Turkey are Muslims, Sunni Muslims. But this shouldn't, that's kind of, yes, that's a reality, but it's also doesn't mean that being Muslim comes with a certain kind of political model. Not everyone born into, a Muslim family necessarily identifies with a certain set of political ideals or political model. So, I mean, you can be a Muslim and you can, opt to live under a secular regime. And, up until this point, I guess, laicism, not necessarily secularism, has been the state's motto and people lived under that. There is also, religious minorities like Alevis that's often ignored. Some consider Alevis, which is, a very extreme shoot of, Shiites for some, for others, some sort of non-Orthodox belief system. 10-20% of the population living in Turkey are Alevis.
So,
there are also non-Muslims, right? There's a, mm-hmm. very small Greek population that's still living in Istanbul. There are Armenians. There are, again, a small number of, Jews. So let's not forget about these groups when we talk about demographics of this country.
So when other countries, we hear talk about the role of Islamic fundamentalism. Is that kind of an inappropriate term for Turkey, or is there an aspect of it that kind of fits with Islamic fundamentalism?
I think AKP government, obviously there was an Islamist, movement in this country. And since, the AKP came to power in 2002, I guess there was at least an Islamic discourse that we all became familiar with. But, up until recently, they actually denied any kind of Islamic project or Islamicizing the system. They were still talking about democracy or, republic. In terms of, whether, AKP is really trying to turn this country into an Islamic state, and whether that's the problem we are having, I'm not really sure about that. Mm-hmm. I think we are having problem. I mean, what we are having problem at this point is it's about authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And it can be a Kemalist authoritarianism or an Islamist authoritarianism. But I think the problem we are having here is, once again, the government leaders are not listening to what
Could I have your thoughts about whether or not Islamic fundamentalism plays any significant role in kind of the politics and culture of Turkey?
As Zeynep explained, vast majority of Turkish population is Muslim. And Turkish Republic in its early years experienced a drastic modernization, secularization project led up to down. So, and again, as Zeynep explained, up until 1950, there had been a one-party rule, 1945, and then in 1950, Atatürk's party peacefully left the government. I would argue that until between 1965 and 1970, the political Islam was underground. Beginning in mid-1960s, Turkey realized that it was basically alienated in the region, and the only real ally of Turkey was the United States at the time, and it didn't really work out for Turkey. So we see a rapprochement between the Islamic world and Turkey, and as an extension of that, Islam found a way in the political rhetoric of Turkey. So there were a number of political parties, Islamic political parties, and AK party, Justice and Development Party, Adalet Party, Justice and Development Party, is an extension, is a continuation of that. And a number of people vote for this political party thinking that their belief system, their religious ideals are represented by the political party. On the other hand, I don't want to dumb down... I'll just stop here.
We do need, you can hear the music. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to start talking about the current unrest. We're going to hear what Zeynep has to say about what's going on in Istanbul right now. So stay tuned and we'll start taking your calls as well.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR brings you the news every day, all year long. News from around the world, across the country, and throughout the state. Breaking news, developing stories, weather and sports. NHPR, keeping New Hampshire connected. More on Granite Staters' take about the turmoil in Turkey coming up on The Exchange at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the push to get health insurance exchanges up and running. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Ford & Associates PA, providing representation for businesses, trustees, and institutional creditors in bankruptcy and troubled debt matters. Ford & Associates PA. From Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association, providing a wide range of personal care and homemaking services to help you achieve greater independence, crvna.org. And Prescott Park Arts Festival, presenting the Riverhouse Restaurant Concert Series with Mary Chapin Carpenter, Judy Collins, Richard Thompson, and more, open to the public, prescottpark.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing the protests in Turkey. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org and keep those short, please. Or you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. I have three guests with me today. In studio, I have Aykut Kulinç. He's a PhD candidate at UNH, and he studies U.S.-Turkish relationships. He's also from Istanbul. I also have in studio Wayne Lesperance. He's a political science professor at New England College, and he studies international relations and U.S. foreign policy. And joining us on the line from Istanbul is Zeynep Türkyılmaz. She's a history professor at Dartmouth College. She's an Istanbul native, and she's currently in Istanbul, as I mentioned. We've given a nice kind of primer and background on the politics and history of Turkey. Let's start talking about the current unrest. Wayne, can you give our listeners sort of a thumbnail sketch of what's happened over the past 3 weeks?
Sure. And so it begins with something that would be very recognizable to Granite Staters, right? You have this park, Gezi Park, in Taksim Square, where there was a redevelopment project in the works. And so you had a group of, a few dozen, 50 or so folks turn out to protest the destruction of this park, basically the removal of a lot of trees and destruction of that green spot, one of the few green spots in the city. And they were met with police reaction to disperse them. And so, you know, that was on the 28th of May. Over the next few days, you had more protesters begin to come, and the police reaction escalated significantly. There are reports of extensive use of tear gas, of water cannons. And so you had protesters, thousands of them up to date, injured as a result of clashes now with the police there. Over time, this grew. It grew far beyond just a protest of a redevelopment project. And I'm not exactly clear. Maybe one of the other guests can say this, what the plan was. There's talk of the rebuilding of a historical barracks. There's talk of putting in a strip mall, that sort of thing. But nevertheless, it was a redevelopment project. To date now, we have seen, as of the 17th of June, just a couple of days ago, a general strike, 78 towns and cities, two large unions in Turkey getting involved in this. And so this has clearly escalated beyond just this one park, this one square, and the issues have grown. So you have a lot of young people. Pew and a university there in Turkey did some studies and trying to profile who these protesters were. Overwhelmingly, these are young people. These are folks who are frustrated with the government. They raise a variety of issues, some of which relate to a conservative Islamic view, restrictions on alcohol sales right after a certain hour, things like that. So the cause and the protests have grown. They have expanded in terms of what they are protesting. And the police reaction to it has been very strong. And as you pointed out earlier, Dean, the response by the government has been very tough.
Tough, right.
Not a lot of conciliatory, not a lot of reaching out to find a way to sort of negotiate this down.
Right. And Zeynep, you're in Istanbul. You're literally right in the middle of this. Is it true that you've actually been in and around some of the protests?
I've been there, yeah. Okay.
Could you give us your general kind of on-the-ground impressions of how things feel right now?
Okay, I was actually in Hanover when this all started. So I followed, you know, the first week from Hanover. And we were, you know, when I was there, when I was talking to my friends, I had the sense that something unusual, something that you're not really used to seeing in Turkey was happening. But you really see that it's a new normal once you hit the ground here and, you know, really get to know people, who these people are. I mean, you are now, you know, this new group of protesters are completely new generation. I mean, these are not, you know, professional protesters or usual suspects, as we call them. Mm-hmm. This is a, you know, generation of 90s. You know, most of these kids never been to any kind of demonstration before. This is their first time. And what, you know, when you talk to these people, what brought them there? I mean, half of them decided to come to Gezi only after they saw police brutality. And these are, you know, people from all walks of life. I mean, and that's, I guess, what makes it really exciting and also, you know, difficult to decipher. Because you can see actually, you know, liberal Islamists, secularists, Turkish nationalists, Kurdish nationalists, you know, those who are, you know, Armenians, Turks, environmentalists, you name it, you know, it's really difficult to say. I mean, you know, this segment of society is trying to make a case against another segment of society. It's really, you know, a coalition of people who, I guess, express their concerns and express their, you know, frustration with the government policy.
Now, Zeynep, is it sort of, given the protests, you know, I've been in Greece during some of the unrest in Athens, and, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't even know that there was anything going on most of the day. How does it feel? Do you feel like things are not normal, that the business isn't as usual, or does it feel like people are going about their business?
You know, in certain neighborhoods, you can just, you know, go normal. Everything is normal. But if you go to, you know, Taksim, Beşiktaş, and, you know, other places, it's really a new normal. You know, most of Taksim is now under police control, you know, and there were often restrictions of public transportation during demonstrations. Mm-hmm. And one of the, you know, most striking things for me when I first, you know, came to Istanbul on the 6th, was that people were walking around with goggles, gym goggles, and, you know, masks. And everybody felt like, you know, nobody looked like strange, right? They were all, you know, okay with that. And I was like, what is going on? I mean, but I guess now, after the, you know, crackdown, and it was a very brutal crackdown, and I mean, I would like to talk a little bit about what excessive means, excessive police use means in this case.
So you've actually seen some violence there and police behavior?
I mean, they, I guess over these 2 weeks, they used 130,000 tear gas canisters on demonstrators. That's apparently twice as much used in entire Europe in 2012. And as you just mentioned, I mean, 2012 was not the most peaceful year in for Europe. I mean, there were demonstrations in Greece, there were demonstrations in Spain. You know, it was a volatile year for entire Europe. But I was there one of the nights, one of the Tuesday nights, and it was difficult to breathe. And
because of the tear gas in the air, right?
Tear gas, yes, and concussion bombs. And, and also, I mean, there were makeshift infirmary, and there were attacks on those infirmaries.
So it sounds like there's just a fair bit of violence being used here. Aykut, you've been active. You're active on social media. What are you hearing from friends back in Istanbul?
I agree with Zeynep and Wayne. The fact is that the demonstration started by a small group of highly educated young people who basically grew up during Erdogan's prime ministry. You know that he's the only political leader they have had experience with. And Gezi Parkı, part of Taksim Square, is very important for Turkish identity, and it started as a simple project that rebuilding Ottoman barracks, and attached to it that there was supposed to be a shopping mall. So the reaction was simply in the beginning just to protect, you know, green space and architecture. And the crackdown and the fact that these young, clean-shaven, you know, well-dressed ladies being beaten up and tear-gassed, that was the, I guess, rapture point for Turkish society. And it galvanized all sorts of people. And I think the demonstrations are quite unique in the sense that it transcended ideological divides, and we saw ultra-nationalists demonstrating with Kurdish people, moderate religious Sunni people, along with communists and atheists. So if there is such a thing called democratic evolution of a country, this was great to see. On the other hand, the erratic and kind of irrational reaction of Prime Minister Erdogan and his political party really exposed the weaknesses of how much power can really corrupt within 10 and a half years.
We're talking about the turmoil in Turkey today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477, or you can email The Exchange at nhpr.org, and please keep those emails brief. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Harry joining us from Rockingham, Rockingham, Vermont. Harry, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, and to all your Turkish guests, I say merhaba.
Merhaba.
I spent a number of years with the Turkish military, and I was a liaison with them. And what impressed me was that they constantly talked about the Turkish constitution, so I did a little study on my own while I was over there. And, of course, I brought up and I said, well, that's very, very interesting. The army is to protect the constitution. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting was that apparently what shocked me over the last few years is that the Turkish military has been marginalized as a result of this this gentleman being in power over 10 years, he successfully has marginalized the military. And when Ataturk set up that constitution, I'm sure your scholars will mention, the fact of the matter is that they were insistent on the fact that the military would always protect the constitution and keep the society secular. That was the biggest point they wanted to make, all about the constitution. It was very important to the military, to the army, and I must say some of the finest soldiers in the world.
So your question, Harry? Do you have a question for our guest?
Well, that's my question. My question is, I know he did it in the first few years, but how did he successfully marginalize the military so that they were not able to, as they have done before, and I was present at one of those revolutions when they took over the government and they coup, and they were very, very professional, but they were concerned about maintaining the Constitution of Turkey.
Let's hear it. Wayne, what do you have to say?
Well, it's a great point that Harry brings up. It is really a rare thing for a military to come out of the barracks, to take control of the government, and then to, once they feel they have finished their work, to go back, to relinquish power. And that is exactly what the Turkish military has done in the past. And so I think they very much see that role as guardians of the Constitution as a very, very important and serious one. It's a really important point. We don't see this very often in other places. Usually the military comes out, they don't leave. In terms of the push, that's also something that will frighten government, that will frighten an aspiring leader, that will frighten somebody who wants to make significant changes and reforms. And so to whatever extent possible, Erdogan makes the changes that he can to sort of keep them in the box, to keep the military from asserting that role to the extent that he can, which allows him greater latitude to do the things that he wants to do. Part of the deal here is that we've kind of not talked about too much is that, you know, in the last election, he won with about 50% of the vote. I mean, it's a significant number in a parliamentary system. So you have a leader who has, you know, enjoyed pretty good support. I mentioned off the air to Dean that, you know, a Pew poll looked at his favorability ratings before the protest, and they were at 62%. That's pretty good. President Obama would like those numbers. So, you know, it's not we can't lose sight, I think, of there's a broader context here that this person came to power legitimately through a democratic election and enjoyed considerable support. Where those numbers are now, who knows?
Now, Erdogan go ahead, Zainab, jump
okay.
in, please.
I will have to disagree with this, you know, military tutelage and democracy business. It's very difficult to have a, you know, open democratic model if you have the military tutelage. I mean, it's either or, you can't really have the both. And I think that was one of the reasons, you know, that's one of the reasons that we have now, you know, a very similar problem here, except that now it's, you know, Erdogan's own tutelage, his own tutelage. Because, I mean, these kind of tutelage models leave very little room for civil society to develop. And especially the constitution written by the military after 1980 coup, you know, basically criminalized large segments of society. And we know that thousands of people were tortured and killed as a result of that military intervention. So it wasn't simply, you know, military intervening and then peacefully going back to their barracks and living society as, you know, vivid and as vibrant as it was before. It was the destruction of the society. Mm-hmm. And it, disempowered civil society seriously. And then that also created, you know, room, a space for other groups to emerge. I mean, feminist movement was one of those that emerged out of, you know, basically erasing the whole leftist politics, civil rights movements. And then others were Islamists who were actually, again, supported, you know, several Islamist groups were supported by the military because they thought that that will be the solution to the left-right divide right. in the society. So I mean, still thinking as, you know, talking about military as, you know, positive influence, as the guardian of the, you know, constitution is exactly the problem. And that's the model that AKP government is trying to replicate at this point. And, when, you know, you very often hear, you know, comparisons when they are criticized anything about that. You know, they say, basically, you know, that's what the Republican Party did. That's what military did. So that's kind of a defense point, and we really need to move beyond that because that's a straitjacket on this society. We can do much better than that. And, in terms of
Zeynep, let me just a brief point about sure.
elections. Threshold, the electoral threshold
right, that's what I
in
want to
Turkey
talk about.
At this point is 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a significant number. That's a significant number that actually leaves, again, you know, whatever view right. we want to call it, out of the parliament.
Now, I have heard Erdogan refer to the 50% who, or actually, this is my question. So Wayne said he got about 50% of the vote. So that means that roughly half the people did not vote for him. He's referred to these protesters as a pesky minority. Is this sort of a small disaffected group, or is it simply the case that, you know, half the country, you know, and Erdogan has been going around the country giving these fiery speeches to huge rallies? Is it the case that the other half of the country is disaffected, or is it a smaller group?
Oh, that's very interesting. First of all, I have to agree with Zeynep that military cannot be the protector of democracy. And over the last few years, the power of the military diminished. But many people are concerned in Turkey that so what happens when there's a power vacuum, and they question what does Erdogan want to accomplish. So in regards to your question, Dean, that I found it very disappointing that Erdogan's rhetoric, the discourse he chose to refer to the other 50% who didn't vote for him as a group of people who basically lacked kind of virtuous identity. He has been quite contemptuous and condescending towards those people, as if they lack morality. So his rhetoric has been quite divisive, and I think that was a contributing factor why many people came out to support the Gezi movement.
I mean, he called people looters. I mean, right. the demonstrators, looters, and in terms of 50%, if I can just jump to that too. I mean, we don't really know what 50%, the other, you know, other 50% thinks, because we hear
Zeynep,
an official discourse.
Zeynep, let me jump in. We have to take our last break of the show. We're coming up. We're going to keep talking about what's going on in Turkey right now. Look a little bit about what might happen in the future, and we'll take more of your calls and emails. So please stay with us.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Granite State Credit Union, providers of local residential and commercial mortgage and equity products with locations statewide, equal housing lender, gscu.org. And from BAE Systems, remembering our servicemen and women and emergency response professionals and their commitment to our country and communities on this Independence Day. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
It's a busy, busy time of day for people as they're getting ready to get out of the house, get in the car, and get to work.
And while you're worried about all of that, NHPR's Rick Ganley has got you covered.
You know, we have a commitment to in-depth news coverage. We want to give you some news, weather information, maybe a sports score, something that is really relevant to you as you are starting your day.
Start your day right with Morning Edition on NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today we're talking about the situation in Turkey and the breakout of protests against the country's prime minister. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, and you can email us a short email at nhpr.org. I'm joined today by three guests. We have in studio Aykut Kulinç, who's a PhD candidate at UNH, and he studies Turkish relations, international relations, Turkey, and he's from Istanbul. Wayne Lesperance, a political science professor at New England College, and Zeynep Türkyılmaz, who's a history professor at Dartmouth. She's also an Istanbul native like Aykut, and she's currently in Istanbul. Wayne, let me go to you first. I have an email here from Leslie at Chichester, and it gets sort of what we were talking about. And Leslie says, my husband just returned from a trip to Turkey, and in support of Zeynep's argument, the protests forces are not just conservationists and leftist extremists. They're everyday people, and they're on the rise. So this gets to this earlier issue of if he got 50% of the vote, what about the other 50%? Is this being driven by everyday people who are rising up, or is it sort of more focused?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points on that, I think. First, the BBC has got some excellent coverage of this, and one of the things that struck me was a photograph I saw, and it was a sort of a camp of protesters and the various flags they had with them. And it was everything from flags with images of Che Guevara to Occupy Wall Street flags, to a variety. There was an Armenian flag. There was different flags representing Kurdish interests. I mean, it was really an interesting collection of different kinds of people. The interviews that they did, these reporters for the BBC found that very few of the folks there are actually political. I mean, I think Zeynep said this earlier, that this is sort of their first time at this. This is their first experience with this sort of thing. And so this is probably not the other 50% in some regards, but this could very well be a coalition of sorts that could create trouble for Erdogan going forward. He has these plans, these ideas of converting Turkey's system to more of a presidential model. This puts all of that in jeopardy, I would say. And so to the extent that these folks become political as a result of this experience, and I think the emailer is right, Leslie's right, that this could grow into something, and it is growing, this could spell, you know, political trouble for him down the road.
Leslie, thank you for that email. Zeynep, let's talk a little bit about some of these comparisons we're hearing in the international media. You hear the Arab Spring mentioned. You hear Occupy Wall Street mentioned. Accurate or inaccurate in your mind as comparisons with what's going on there now?
I think it's most inaccurate. I mean, I think dignity is an issue here as well. That's something that we heard very often with the Arab Spring, right? I mean, people's, you know, desire to be recognized as human beings. And I guess here the issue is, you know, these people on the street want to be recognized as citizens with full rights and freedom. And especially the use of tear gas is seen as an, you know, disrespectful and, you know, attacking their dignity. The trajectory of the Turkish political model is fundamentally different than, you know, the Arab countries. So, you know, with all its problems, we have an electoral system. And we have, I would say, a more dynamic and vibrant, you know, civil society structures. Again, with all its, I'm not trying to idolize anything, but, I think the comparison in that sense is a little bit problematic. I guess people here not really trying to overthrow Erdogan government.
Right.
They just want accountability, and accountability means that they want to know who killed 4 people on the street. You know, who are these police who shot directly, targeted people's heads, and as a result of that, you know, 11 people lost their eyes. And they want to know, you know, why police raided into hotel lobbies and, you know, hospitals and tear gas. And that's, you know, crime against humanity.
So really is this something, it sounds to me from what you're saying that this is something that has really kind of shocked the Turkish people. And Aykut, let me get Aykut in on this. You've sort of mentioned the problematic nature of these comparisons. So I'd like your input on that as well.
First of all, Recep Tayyip Erdogan is not Assad. He's not Gaddafi. He's not Mubarak. So the context is different. On the other hand, in terms of the emergence of the Gezi movement, is quite similar to the Arab Spring and American Occupy movement, that it starts with a small spark. Information disseminates very fast. And a platform is easily created for people to voice their discontent in Turkish content towards the arbitrary exercise of power by Erdogan over the last few years. On the other hand, I'm not suggesting that the Gezi movement wouldn't have happened had Arab Spring hadn't happened. But I see a lot of similarities, and we have been hearing about Brazil, for instance, the demonstrations in Brazil. So I think globally we are experiencing a new generation voicing its discontent through using the media.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Tuna joining us from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Tuna, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Good to be on. I initially only had a question, but I'd like to make a comment if I have a few seconds.
We're running out of time, but if you could keep it brief and give us your question.
Sure. I'm going to touch up on what Zeynep and Harry said earlier, one of your callers, about the military's role in Turkey. And Zeynep did say that, you know, Turkey should move away from that. But I think Erdogan has given us a reason why we can't move from that, is because he did not only marginalize the military, but he's squashing his opposition, journalists and judges, and who can actually pose an opposition to him by jailing them. And I think we have several thousand people in jail as we speak today. But my other point is actually a question. And Erdogan is a leader who refers to his population as us and those who opposes them as them. How does Turkey move from such a dividing comment from its leader? How Turkish people reunite if they're referred to as us and them? And I'll take my answer on off the air.
Very interesting question. Zeynep, what do you think?
Yes, I would like to take
sure,
those questions.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think, you know, Erdogan wants to portray this movement as those with aspirations for a coup d'etat. And I think, you know, justifying a military tutelage on the basis of what Erdogan is doing at this point is a big problem and would be completely wrong. We need a democratic society. We need more channels for free speech and, a stronger legal system. We don't need military to tell, you know, us what to do and what not to do, because that's going to be just like what is, you know, taking place right now. We need, you know, a political process that will let people, you know, have more representation, right? I mean, we need to problematize 10% nationwide threshold. I mean, that 10% was used to prevent Kurds from entering the parliament. That was used to prevent, you know, Islamist groups from entering the parliament. And now we see that. Now, you know, Erdogan is actually using that to, you know, silence people and not letting them have representation. And so I think the only solution to this problem is more democracy, more civil society, and not yet, you know, another military tutelage or police state. You know, we cannot, I mean, it's not either or. We can't function in this dichotomy. We need a third solution. And I guess at this point, what people are doing is the third solution. I mean, I've attended a number of neighborhood forums. So those who were cracked down, you know, brutally cracked down in Gezi are actually now taking, you know, meeting at parks in different neighborhoods of Istanbul. And I've attended quite a few. And every night, you know, at parks, there are thousands of people, you know, sitting together and talking about, you know, their goals, what they want to, you know, achieve by this movement. And they want something new. We can't really go back. We need to move forward. And I think that's very important.
Tuna, thank you for that call. Wayne, let me turn to you. I'd like to hear your thoughts as well. And then let's segue into talking a little bit about whether this has any impact or concern at all for American foreign policy, or maybe even with regard to Turkish potential membership in the European, the EU.
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. I think the first thing I'd say to Zeynep, not to be, I guess, to play the role of contrarian this morning.
That's allowed.
Okay. So it's a bit of a tricky tension that's happening, because I'm completely with you. I want to see vibrant democratic institutions that exist to protect individuals that are empowering, that convey dignity. But it doesn't seem to me that in this case that's what Erdogan is doing. And to the extent that he's making it harder for those institutions to flourish through the different things that he's done, sort of gets us back to Tuna's point, that at what point do you have some institution like the military begin to exert itself to say that we're not going to allow these violations to continue or to take place? It's not a preferred role for sure, but I don't know that it's one that's avoidable if this sort of thing continues to happen. Turkey's in an interesting place in terms of foreign policy. The United States really needs Turkey. What's going on in Syria, Turkey has absorbed a tremendous number of refugees. The Turks have had, you know, there's been an exchange of artillery along the border with the Syrians. Any effort for the U.S. to intervene in Turkey, as President Obama has begun to discuss, will come from either Jordan – sorry, intervene in Syria – will come from either Jordan or Turkey. And so that relationship is an important one. I've read analysts describe it as sort of a bittersweet honeymoon, this return to, you know, a good relationship. I've heard others describe it as a model relationship for other countries in the region. I suspect it's someplace in between. So the policy between the United States and Turkey is important, and Turkey's relationship with its neighbors. In terms of our goals with Iran, in terms of our goals with keeping Iraq whole, all of this Turkey plays a central role in for the U.S. And so, you know, that this all gets complicated by these kinds of things.
And let me bring in Aykut here. Your sense of either – we could talk a little about foreign policy, but if anything interesting about the impact for potential membership in the European Union or its closest neighbors?
I think Merkel, a few days ago, she suggested that maybe talks with Turkey should be on the back burner for a while. So this has been a complete failure for the AK Party. If I may, I would like to just briefly talk about what Erdogan is trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely.
He is trying to recreate an Ottoman identity. When he goes to bed at night, I don't think he is dreaming of, you know, another Saudi Arabia, another Iran or Yemen. But I think he is longing for the good old days of the Ottoman Empire. And his project is two-pronged. On the one hand, he is trying to recreate a Turkish society by claiming public spaces. And I think the Gezi Square, Gezi Park, Taksim Square is an extension of that. Personally, I'm kind of perplexed, and I haven't really chosen my side. Most Turkish public spaces and squares, they're kind of ugly. They represent the, you know, the taste of 1920s and 1930s German and Italian perspectives. So they're cold and alienating. And AK Party is trying to replace that with some type of ugly kitsch. So it's one kind of tasteless thing is trying to be replaced by another tasteless thing. So in foreign relations, if I may continue, please just show me your hand if
sure.
whenever
sure.
you
we just like have a couple minutes left, but
okay.
absolutely, go
okay.
ahead.
Okay, and I'm going to, I would like to just connect that to the U.S.'s
sure.
interests.
Sure.
So in foreign relations, Erdogan really departed from traditional Turkish policy, and over the last few years, he has been trying to present Turkey as the leader of the Sunni world. So he has been quite active. He was active, quite active during the Arab Spring, the height of the Arab Spring, and he has been taking on Assad, Syria, just to be the leader of the Sunni world. And the United States needs to be wary of this a war between Syria and Turkey would be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And with his kind of pro-Sunni policies, Erdogan is helping Iran, Syria, and Iraq to have some type of rapprochement, which is going to be quite detrimental mm-hmm. for U.S.'s interests. So Erdogan is playing with fire.
Yep. Zeynep, we only have about 2 minutes left, but I'd like to hear your thoughts. And also, if you give us a sense of where you think this is going in the coming weeks.
Let me start with the second one. I think these neighborhood platforms are, you know, going to continue and evolve into some sort of perhaps some sort of a platform, a nationwide platform. And some, you know, people already started talking about possibly a party, you know, turning this into a political party and starting a more, you know, continuing with the conversation and let people come together and speak and, you know, get to know each other. Because, you know, we've gone through such a fragmented time that, you know, Turks don't speak to Kurds and, you know, Muslims completely ignore. And in terms of that, I think there are, you know, whether political party will, you know, finalize and, you know, will really happen, I think this process is a healthy process. Society's willingness to recognize each other.
Zeynep, we're almost out of time. Just a real quick question to you. On a personal note, do you have any concerns about your family or your safety while you're there?
It's very hard to know what action the government is take after this, you know, neighborhood. It's very hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. And Wayne, real quick to you, just to kind of wrap up, where do you see this going in the coming weeks?
Well, I think that this continues, and I think that it continues to escalate. It sounds from what Zeynep is saying that there's an infrastructure, an intellectual, a sort of protest infrastructure being developed in these communities. I mean, if Erdogan wants to play this smartly, the advice I would give him, not that he would seek it from me, is to learn two very important words in New Hampshire, local control. Mm-hmm. Give this to the folks in Istanbul, let them deal with it, and step away.
Well, we are out of time, and I think we're all going to be watching the situation very closely. But it's been a great discussion today. I want to thank my guests. In studio, Aykut Kulinc is a PhD candidate at UNH, and he studies U.S.-Turkish relations, and he's from Istanbul. Wayne Lesperance is a political science professor at New England College, and he studies international relations and U.S. Foreign policy. Aykut and Wayne, thank you so much for being in here in studio.
Thanks, Tim.
And joining us from Istanbul has been Zeynep Türkyılmaz. She's a history professor at Dartmouth College, also an Istanbul native. Zeynep, thank you so much, and please be safe over there.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Faith Mikesill and Catherine Muzzy. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.